My assignment is to moderate the second panel. And what we're going to do is discuss some broader issues that relate to achieving strong growth, achieving widespread income gains across all levels, and increasing economic security for the long term. That is to say, the objectives of the Hamilton Project. The panel's resumes are in your materials, so I won't repeat them. Let me just remind you once again that our outstanding panel members are Alan Blinder, Gordon S. Rentschler, Memorial Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University, the Honorable Sherrod Brown, United States Senator from the great state of Ohio, Ed Glaser, Fred and Eleanor Glimp Professor at Harvard University, and Alice Rivland, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, and also, I believe, Visiting Professor at Georgetown University. And Alan and Alice are also members of the Hamilton Project Advisory Council. The question, very broadly put, is what policies are necessary or best to achieve the objectives that I mentioned a moment ago over the long term. And we operate on the premise that's in the strategy paper that the United States has tremendous comparative advantages in our mobility, our dynamism, other characteristics, so that we really do believe that the United States can do very well in a transforming global economy if we rise to meet the great challenges that we face and if we're willing to make hard choices. Clearly, the number one priority of policymakers today has to be to deal with the terrible toll that I mentioned in my opening remarks that come from the Great Recession. And that is an issue that I'm sure will consume policymakers for quite some time to come. At the same time, we must also focus on the long term, and it's really the long term that is the focus of the Hamilton Project, or at least predominantly the focus of the Hamilton Project, and that will be a continuation of that discussion is what our second panel will do. Let me briefly express my views on a few matters that I think are central contextually to a discussion of long-term economic policy. Number one, there are widely varying opinions on the short-term outlook of the United States economy. And what happens in the short term, at least in my view, is also very important with respect to our ability to put in place policies now and even over time to address our longer-term challenges. I think there's a pretty broadly held view that the first couple of quarters this year are likely to be strong for a whole host of reasons. The question is, are those temporary reasons or will they be ongoing? Once you get beyond that, opinions vary greatly. There's a strongly held view, a widely held view, that the momentum of various factors that contributed to the growth in the first two quarters will continue and that we can have robust growth for a substantial period of time. And I think possibility, but it also seems to me that we face enormous headwinds with high unemployment, a weakened consumer, the fact that the deficit, the expansionary effect of the deficit begins to decline in the third quarter, although deficits are still very, very high for as far as you, out in the future as you can see, state and local deficits, which Ben Bernanke mentioned the other day, a variety of other factors. So I think there's at least a realistic possibility that we could revert back to a much slower and bumpier growth than any of us would desire and for an extended period of time. Number two, many of you travel internationally and are familiar with foreign economies. I don't think there's any question that there is an imperative that we act on our long-term challenges driven by the transformative change taking place in the global economy, including the growth of China, India, Brazil, many of the Asian countries, their greatly increasing productivity, the massive transfers of wealth to oil-producing and trade surplus countries, a rapid, ongoing, and hugely impactful technological development, and much else. Number three, as was discussed some in the first panel, our own country is inadequately addressing K-12 education, scientific research, or energy policy, infrastructure, and many other areas that are critical to long-term success and areas in which our competitors are moving rapidly. Number four, we have unsustainable fiscal deficits for the years and decades ahead. In addition, we have large annual maturities that have to be funded. These conditions pose multiple risks, varying degrees of severity. They're discussed in the strategy paper. I won't repeat them. Let me just make two observations. Number one, although the risks, the probability of these risks materializing is obviously greater as you go out in time, the psychology of markets can change unpredictably and rapidly. And I don't think we can write off, we cannot discount the possibility, at least, of some of these risks materializing in the shorter term. Although, as I say, with much lower probability of that happening. And secondly, large deficits constrain our ability to engage in public investment, and they constrain our ability to react with resilience to geopolitical economic emergencies. Next item, immigration remain unresolved and critically important. And then the last item that I'll mention is that market-based economics and government, strong government, to meet the needs that markets by their very nature will not address, are often viewed as antithetical. The Hamilton Project views them as complementary. And one of the observations that President Clinton used to make is that too often those who emphasize one half of that pair would tend to underestimate the importance of the other. Now let's turn to the panel. What I'll do is ask each panelist to comment for a bit on a subject that I know is of interest to them, or at least I've been told is of interest to them. We'll find out in a moment. If I'm wrong, then they'll comment on something else. Yeah, whatever they want. Any event, it's a terrific panel. So once they're done, we'll do this a little differently than the first panel did it. We'll sort of go through that. We'll go through those comments, and then once we do that, we'll have a free-flowing discussion amongst ourselves with respect to the issues that they've discussed, and then, as I say, we'll deal with questions. So let us start with our senator from the great state of Ohio, Sherrod Brown.
Bob, thank you, and it's a pleasure and honor to be here. Is that working?
Is the mic working?
Is my mic working? No. Am I supposed to turn it on?
No,
they should turn it on. It could be a conspiracy to silence senators, but let's hope not.
Here comes a techie.
Yep, here comes somebody.
You want to switch?
Let's switch. Here we go. Oops, there you go.
Apologize for being a moment late. I actually have brought in every year, I invite 50 or 60 college presidents from Ohio, two-year, four-year schools, private and public. Ohio has either second or third most private four-year schools of higher education, four-year colleges and universities of any state in the country, private schools in addition, obviously, to an extensive community college and university network. And more on that later, but that's obviously a big part of our discussion is what we do in clean energy and aerospace, Ohio. In many ways, is a leader in both. We have more Airbus investment in our state by far than any state in the nation. We got more jobs in clean energy from the stimulus package than any other state. Toledo, Ohio, believe it or not, has more solar energy manufacturing jobs than any city in the country. And I preface that to show you that Ohio really is looking forward in a lot of kind of best practices and innovative manufacturing. And in addition to biomedical and a lot of other things we do. Let me put the discussion, at least from my fifth of it or fourth of it, into a bit of an historical context. That while we absolutely should be talking about how we in a macro way make this economy work, and that's about, it's about profits and economic growth to be sure, but at the same time we should also put it in the perspective of what this means for workers in our country and for wages. You can look at what, without too much historical context, from 1946 to 1973, we saw the people that on the bottom half or the bottom 80% see their wages go up, and we saw a lot of economic growth during that period since 1973, less so, and especially since 2000. And while putting aside the economic condition we're in today, in the last 2 years, go back to 2006 or 7, and look what happened in the decade since 2000, the beginning of this millennium. We saw economic growth. We saw a recovery coming out of a a minor recession at the turn of the millennium, if you will. We saw good economic growth. We saw good profits for industry, for employers, for companies, and we saw almost terrifically increased productivity from a workforce. What we didn't see is growth in income for most of America. So to me, the economy should always be measured with always a focus on what does this mean for 80% of our country, not just as important as economic growth is, as important as profits are. We need all those things, of course. But when we have seen, if you chart productivity increases in this country since World War II, you can see pretty much of the time the wages kept up with productivity, particularly since from 46 to 73, but even since then until 2000, when as productivity continues to climb, workers' wages did not climb. So economic growth, when it's not shared by large numbers of people, is certainly worth something to our country, but it's not what it should be. And that's where our focus absolutely needs to be. It's not what we talk about much in seminars like this. It's not what we talk about much on Capitol Hill. It's not what the nation's newspapers and the pundits on MSNBC or Fox or CNN talk about. It really is where the focus in my mind should always be. How do we get economic growth, and how do we see the kind of wage increases for white collar and blue collar alike? I lay a good bit of that at the feet of what the focus in our economy has been from the sort of macro players, the most influential players in our country's economy, in terms of Wall Street, in terms of elected officials, in terms of economic advisors at the White House and throughout in our universities and throughout the system that way. And so what I would get to is where's been the emphasis in our economy? And I'll give you a few statistics without overdoing them. In 1980, manufacturing was about a third of our GDP. Financial service was less than half of that, so less than one-sixth of our GDP. By 2005, that had been flipped, so that manufacturing is now, I think, roughly one-sixth of our GDP, again, now meaning before the recession. Before the worst part of the recession has hit, manufacturing's about a sixth of the GDP. Financial services is much more than that. And while I'm always supportive of innovation in anything, if it's done properly, we've put way more emphasis on innovation in financial services than we have in manufacturing. We have since 1980, we really have pursued a policy of favoring financial services over manufacturing. This didn't happen by accident. It's trade law, it's tax law, it's who we bail out in difficult situations, whether it's it was the savings and loans of a couple of decades ago, whether it was the big hedge fund of a decade ago, whether it's Wall Street most recently. That's where our emphasis has been. It's not been on the right kind of long-term predictable tax credits and energy tax credits and investment tax credit for innovation and manufacturing. It's not been in trade law, has not helped us. It's really given more incentives to outsource than it has to do production. I would end with this, and this is perhaps the best example. I go back to my state. I voted for the stimulus package, Recovery Act. It was controversial, but it was what we needed to do. It's clearly been the right thing. It's clearly served our country well. I don't think there's any real reason debate to say otherwise. But I also have to go back and argue when we put direct dollars into wind turbines in a West Texas wind turbine field, if you will, and most of those wind turbines are made in China. I have to go back and explain to my constituents why that's not such a bad thing, that their tax dollars are going to build to be paid to manufacture in a country that already has a billion dollar a day trade surplus with the United States. And I've been critical of the administration, how they've handled it. I've also understanding that we aren't capable, frankly, of building wind turbines today in the United States. We make component parts, a lot of them in Ohio, frankly, but we aren't able to do all we need to do in wind and solar in the state. What does that say about what we've let happen to our industrial base, that we can't build wind turbines with American workers in this country, we can't build solar with American workers in this country? Oberlin College, 20 miles from where I live, has the largest building on any college campus in America fully powered by solar energy. Solar panels were made in Germany. Wind turbine technology was developed. The technology that's used around the world was developed 15 miles from my house in Sandusky, Ohio. It's a NASA project. 1980, the Reagan administration said, we're done with that. They lost their clean energy mission. With it, they lost a whole lot of expertise, not just to innovate, but to innovate and then commercialize that innovation. If we're going to succeed as a middle-class nation, if we're going to succeed at creating wealth for large swaths of people, and I know everybody up here agrees that's what we want to do. I think the emphasis isn't always where it ought to be from any of us, frankly, but we've got to pay attention to the kind of innovative, cutting-edge manufacturing in aerospace and biomedical work and in clean energy.
Senator, I think all of us would agree with you. We're supposed to go from panelist to panelist and then do our question. I'd like to ask you one question,
sure,
if I may.
Sure.
I don't think there's anything you said that doesn't strike me as absolutely sensible. If you were king, which in our political system, maybe better, we'd be better off with one than anything. If you were king, what would you do politically? What would you do substantively to try to address the objectives that you have, given the changes in the global environment and the competitiveness that we have from China, India, and others that are not just low-cost labor anymore, but now really are highly efficient and highly productive participants in a lot of the areas you're talking about?
Three or four things. I would I'd start with what we do with helping manufacturing companies transition with capital because of the difficulty of attaining capital for them, attracting capital into supply chain of clean energy, for instance. If you can make glass for trucks, you can make glass for solar panels. If you can make gears for cars, you can make gearboxes for wind turbines. I would have a federal revolving loan program, if you will, to begin to help industry transition that way. I would enforce trade laws the way President Obama's done, against the advice of most of Wall Street and almost every newspaper publisher in the country. He enforced in a big way to, and actually not huge issue, not affecting huge numbers of companies, but significant, a Chinese tire issue where it's clear that there was a surge in breaking trade laws and agreements and what happened with something called oil country tubular steel, and we'll go into details there. I think we need longer-term R&D tax credits and to make sure we're doing that, I think, pretty well in the Senate. Workforce investment connecting local manufacturers and local service industries with managing and training workforce better than we have. I look at a BRAC kind of model that we should use, the base closing model, when a community is devastated. Wilmington, Ohio, a town of 12,000, lost a company called DHL, 7,000 employees. It was the biggest employer in six counties in that region, small counties. That's devastation when that happens, and we need a kind of a BRAC sort of. And the president's been very helpful in moving in that direction. And then an increased emphasis on SBA and Ex-Im Bank to help with exports. The Administrator Mills has moved in the right direction in that way. They need to do larger amounts, larger guarantees for small business loans, because manufacturing especially needs more money than a service company. And last thing I'd say is unionization. We need to make it easier to organize so that workers can get a piece of the action. The fact that since 73, productivity has that wages haven't kept up with productivity is a lot of things. It's trade, it's tax law, it's oil, but it's also the fact that there is significantly lower rate of unionization in this country. And our best days as a country were the middle class grew and people could work their way out of poverty was when we had higher unionization rates. I know that that's not the only reason, but that's a big part of the reason.
Senator, I think you've stated one of the great challenges that we face as a country, and the question that you stated, if I understand it correctly, is can we revive manufacturing in this country in ways that make sense and that are competitive and are very difficult?
We can.
And that's a very constructive set of policies. Alice, whatever we do, there is a reality that faces us, and that is our fiscal reality, one I know that you're enormously focused on. So why don't I ask you if you comment a bit on that, and I guess at least two parts of that question might be, The senators laid out a number of areas in which we could work. Some of them actually are not budgetary.
A lot of them are. Yeah.
A lot of them really involve very little budgetary effect. On the other hand, there's an awful lot that we would have to do that would involve budgetary effect. So how do we deal with our deficit? How do we deal with the terrible problem we have right now, high unemployment and high deficit? How do we work our way through that? And how do we make room for public investment? And also, if we're going to commit to the future with respect to deficit reduction, how do we do that in a way that's credible?
Is that all?
Well, that's a beginning, and then you launch from there, and you go forward.
I think that getting on top of our long-run unsustainability in the federal deficit and the federal budget is a precondition both for a strong, sustained recovery and for a strong growth in the economy going forward. We can't do that if we have to borrow larger and larger amounts every year in our federal budget. It will drive interest rates very high. It will provoke at some point a moment at which our creditors, and some of our creditors are in this room and about half of them are overseas, our creditors will lose confidence in the U.S. Government as a sustainable enterprise. Now, we don't know when, as you said yourself, Bob, earlier, we don't know when we might have a crisis. It probably, given the faith in the United States as a strong economy, which we all believe in, we can go on borrowing money for a while. We're not Greece, but we don't want to become Greece. And there's a really serious problem of how long we can go on doing this. The basic problem, as you know, is as you look down the road, spending is simply going to rise inevitably under current policies faster than any growth rate that we are thinking about. And revenues don't go up that fast. In any given set of tax rates, they go up about as fast as the economy grows. So you have a growing wedge. Now, that's an old story. That was true 5 years ago. It was true 10 years ago. But what has happened in the last couple of years is, of necessity, we've had a big recession. We've had to borrow a lot more automatically, because that's what recessions do, and to counteract the recession, to do the stimulus, and I agree with Senator Brown, we had to do it, and to rescue our financial system, which I wish we hadn't been forced to do, but we were, that's driven up the debt. So we face a difficult long-run problems, but from a much higher point of debt relative to the GDP. And Michael had a chart earlier, or somebody did, showing how fast that goes up. Now, there are only two ways to attack this. It's higher revenues and it's bending the curve of future spending. Not spending less, but having it grow less rapidly. We've got to do both. The president has appointed me, among others, to a bipartisan commission that's supposed to tackle this. We aren't going to have a magic solution. We aren't going to do everything at once, but I hope we can help. It's got to be bipartisan. It's got to be both taxes and spending. But a natural question is the one that was implied, that you implied, won't this derail the recovery? I don't think so. I think we will derail the recovery if we don't do it. We need to enact now, being as soon as possible, measures that will control the long-run deficit. They won't have to take effect in the recovery period. They couldn't if you were doing something like fixing Social Security, which would be high on my priority list. You would phase it in very far in the future. It's not going to affect the recovery. The health bill has already put in place measures that can help reduce the rate of growth of health spending. We need to accelerate and reinforce those, but they aren't going to bend spending very fast. But we have to reassure our creditors that we're serious, that we're doing this, and we have a plan to do it. And won't making this continued effort to keep the budget sustainable make it harder to grow the economy? It'll make it intellectually more difficult because we got to find more intelligent ways to finance infrastructure, for instance. We've got to find ways that finance skill development that aren't just throwing money at the educational system on top of what we've already got. As at the end of the last panel, we talked about reorienting priorities, and that's really important. It can't just be, let's spend some more on top of what we're already spending.
Alice, this may be an unfair question. Therefore,
there are no unfair questions.
You talk about the recovery period, and I gather your theory of the case would be that your deficit reduction activity would really only begin to take effect after we've gotten through the recovery. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, now? Nope.
Yeah, speak directly into it.
All right. How about now? Yes, no, some. Here's what we'll do. Daniel Webster managed without a microphone. Let's see if this works.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay. I know, I was going to say to Alice that I think, if I understand it correctly, that the underlying theory of the case would be that we push for recovery now, but we have a credible longer-term program that takes effect after the recovery is well underway.
Yeah, but it's already law.
What?
But then it would already be law.
Already be enacted.
Yeah.
And so my question is, and it's sort of an unfair question, but how long do you think we're going to need in terms of a recovery period so we get to the point where whatever it is that you propose doing can begin to take effect without adversely affecting that the momentum of that recovery?
We don't know, but I think the answer is the recovery will be stronger if we actually put these things in place. And most of what we would naturally be talking about couldn't take effect quickly. Fixing Social Security, for instance, nobody's going to do things that will affect people who are already retired or about to retire. So you're talking quite far in the future. Tax increases, suppose, and it's not a recommendation, suppose we had a value-added tax. I think there's some strong arguments for shifting more toward consumer taxation, as long as it's not too regressive. But you couldn't do that in 2 years or even probably four. You'd have a long entry period. So I'm not worried that legislation, serious legislation, is going to take effect so quickly that it'll derail the recovery.
So, if I may, the thought in that then is that we'll have strong enough recovery over three, four, period of that sort to enable us to then put into effect the kinds of measures you're talking about.
You bet. And I think we should already have done it. I mean, I think it would have been smart of the Obama administration to have put some measure, like perhaps Social Security reform, in their first or second budget, not wait.
The reason I pressed you a little bit on that is Eric Mindich, who's here, and I were at a dinner last night with a very, since it's off the record, I won't say it is, but a world-known columnist. His argument with respect to what's happening in Europe is sort of the same in a way that if we can buy time, if somehow or other we can get strong enough growth over 3, 4, 5 years, then those countries get into a better position to absorb what look like inevitably are going to be some very difficult sovereign fiscal adjustments in Europe. And so we're all sort of betting on the same thing, that growth over a 2 or 3 or 4 year period will be strong enough to then enable us to do the fiscal, and that by enacting something now fiscally, we get enough confidence in the markets to enable that growth to occur.
Right. And we don't want to wait so long that we have no choices. Greece waited too long.
Oh, very well. Yeah. Greece waited a long time. We actually done some other countries. Oh, that's good. Let's turn to Alan, I guess. Alan, in addition to everything else that we've discussed, if you would like to comment on it, my impression is that you have some thoughts on the very issue that the senator was so focused on, which is this question of we've had this growth, we've had productivity growth, but our income distribution has really been, has not been good. It's been bad. And why don't you take that up?
I will. Thank you very much, Bob. I guess I'd like to preface what I want to say, but very, very briefly, by underscoring what several speakers before me have said, which is that the first order of priority is there has to be a rapid return to full employment. Every one of these long-run issues that we're talking about, and I want to mention two, will be much harder in a weak economy and much easier in a strong economy. And I guess I want to emphasize the much part. It makes a very, very big difference. Now, having said that, what I want to talk about in my 5 minutes is two long-run issues that we don't usually think of as budget issues, starting with the inequality issue, which are made much worse by this horrific long-run budget unsustainability problem that we have that Alice was just speaking about. So starting with inequality, which Senator Brown was speaking about, and which, by not incidentally, is one of the signature concerns of the Hazbin, one of the signature concerns of the Hamilton Project from its inception. It's kind of a forgotten issue right now, and that's understandable. We're having hard times, and people are concerned with lots of other things. But as the senator reminded us, with a few interruptions, thank heaven for the interruptions, inequality has been on the rise in the United States for 30-plus years, give or take. Now, that's a very long time. And it has accumulated to a very large increase in income inequality. I'd like to call that un-American, but since we've been doing it for 30-plus years, I probably can't say that. It's at least unfair, and I'm pretty sure it's socially corrosive in a variety of dimensions. So what to do about it? When you ask economists about the inequality problem, they reflect, and I include myself in this, they reflexively think of the tax transfer system. That's why we have a progressive income tax. That's why we have an inheritance tax. On the other end, that's why we have the EITC and TANF and a whole variety, Head Start and a whole variety of other things that do, without using bow and arrow, what Robin Hood did or allegedly did. A very long centuries ago, which is redistribute income from the top towards the bottom. I want to emphasize that because for this country, for quite a long time, was redistributing income from the bottom to the top. At very least, we ought to stop doing that. But economists think first, second, third, and sometimes only about using the tax transfer system to redistribute income in the downward direction. Trouble with that right now is that this, and probably for some years to come, since we're not about to get back to a 4.5% unemployment rate anytime soon, is that this is pretty unpopular right now, politically and in every other respect. And the point I want to emphasize, which keys off what Alice was just saying, is that if we think now about raising taxes, say, on upper income groups, which obviously we are thinking about, it was part of the health reform, for example, we desperately need that revenue for other things. In that case, it was to pay for the health reform, and the next round is going to be for deficit reduction. So this Robin Hood method of raising upper bracket taxes to pay for transfers doesn't look very viable going forward. So I reached the unhappy conclusion that we need to tackle this problem in other ways, and the problem is, what are those other ways? It's just not. There's a reason that economists reflexively think of the tax transfer system. That's the obvious way to do it. It's easy to say, but hard to do, that we need some sort of a change in the social contract. I think a lot of us observed over the last generation plus a change in the social contract that was very hostile to working Americans. Part of that was the decline in unionization that Senator Brown mentioned before, but there are other parts. And so I just think that, and I also think that it's very unlikely that this is going to be done entirely through legislation in Washington. There are a whole lot of people in society and businesses and unions and in education that need to get involved in this, and that it's going to require some of the kind of new thinking that I think and I hope the Hamilton Project stands for. The other thing, if I could just take 2 minutes, I got five, right?
You got five.
I want to say something in sort of a similar vein about an unrelated problem, which is climate change. again, speaking as an economist, I think almost all of us economists think that you can have as much hortatory language as you want, but until we get the prices of fossil fuels higher, nothing's really going to work. It's nice to talk about green technologies, and we ought to be the center of green technology, and I agree with that completely. But I think the first, second, third, fourth, fifth most important ways to do that is to make fossil fuels more expensive in the United States. Then let the private sector go to work, because they will find 15,000 ways to do this that none of us up here and none of the congressmen in Washington would ever think about. But they need the incentives that market systems create. So what does that mean? It means a carbon tax or its first cousin, a cap and trade system. And I would emphasize, and this again keys off what Alice was saying a moment ago, that it's very clear what the right solution here is, putting politics aside, which is whether it's going to be a tax or whether it's going to be through whether it's going to be through a rising tax or a tightening cap and trade system. The whole idea is to make this painless in the short run and increasingly painful as you go out, so that businesses can plan on an ever-rising cost of fossil fuels and start building the kind of plant and equipment, motor vehicles, houses, buildings, etc., that will economize on the use of fossil fuels. That's just very obvious economically, and I just wish the political system, I wish the political system could be that rational and farsighted, but I know that it won't be. I mean, you can blame this on James Madison, who went to Princeton in the 1760s. It's not going to happen politically. And finally, to tie this back, finally, to what Alice was saying, whether you look at this as an economic problem, a problem of economic efficiency, which is the way economists like to look at it, or look at it as a political problem, as I was just suggesting, that problem is a whole lot easier if you can, say, raise a carbon tax and give back the revenue in other forms. You could cut payroll taxes, you could cut corporate taxes, you could cut income taxes. And that's the way economists have been thinking about this for three generations or something. But I come now back to what Alice was reminding us. We're now in the rotten position where, as we have to think about raising taxes on energy, say, we're almost certainly going to have to devote most of the revenue to deficit reduction, and that just makes it much, much stickier.
Alan, could you expand? And I know we're supposed to move from person to person, but you raised the provocative question of, if you don't take the traditional economists, what you sort of call reflexive reaction to distribution accomplishment, what alternatives are there?
Well, I mean, as I was saying, I think it's really hard. I mean, that's what I'd like the Hamilton Project to work on. But I'll give you one concrete example that the senator alluded to before. The increasing unionization through CARCHEC, which a lot of us supported, even with reservations, is one way to pick away at this deterioration of the social contract towards capital and away from labor. There was a couple of allusions have been made to the relative size of the financial sector versus other things, which I think probably we're going to get some natural, the economy is doing that naturally right now, in a very harsh way. As I said before, it's high time, and I think we've now done it with this. We've clearly done it with this administration, as opposed to the previous and to the Reagan years, that we stopped the piling on by the state. What we've had for most of the last 30, 35 years is the market system turning ferociously against people with less education, less skill, etc., and then the government piling on with a tax system that was exacerbating the problem rather than ameliorating it. I think we stopped that. I hope it's not just temporarily. But it's only an amelioration. It's not getting down to the fundamental thing. And finally, I wish I knew how to make the education system work better for the underprivileged, but I was completely taken with $2 a book I said to Roland before, I'm willing to pitch in. You know, count me down for 1,000 books at $2. I mean, I think it's a fantastic use of money.
Could I know Ed's next, but could I just put a human face on something he just said about unionization and card check? Because it's not going to be card check if we move it at all. It will be an accelerated election, an accelerated arbitration if necessary, but an accelerated negotiation process. That's minutia. Maybe you don't care about much, but I was in Cincinnati, most conservative part of my state, about 2 years ago, speaking at a dinner. The front table, it was an AFL-CIO dinner, I can't remember exactly, but the front table were 10 mostly, I think almost one man, nine women, roughly, I think, and African-American and immigrants. And they had just signed their first union contract. They were representing 1,200 janitors in Cincinnati. And I went and I sat down at their table with them to talk to them about what it meant. They had just signed the agreement literally 2 hours earlier. And one woman said to me, she said, we signed this agreement. We have health care, not particularly good health care, I would assume. Not very high wages, but she said, this is the first time in my life I will have a week's vacation. I will have a paid week's vacation as a result of this unionization of this agreement. These people weren't going to get rich. They were janitors in all of the downtown office buildings. They're probably making $13 or $14 an hour, but they get a paid week's vacation. My guess is everybody in this room that dresses like this has had paid vacations. It's not necessarily a human right, but it's sort of what we stand for in this country. You get a decent wage, you get health care, you get some kind of a pension. And you get a week's or 2 weeks vacation that you earned. And why can't we do that in this country?
Okay. We'll turn to Ed in just one second. Can I ask you a question,
sure. Senator?
And maybe somebody, Alan, you may know the answer, or Ed. I remember a similar panel once in some discussion with respect to this very same question of unionization. The observation, I remember made the observation, but I won't cite the name just because if I misrepresent it, I don't want to have somebody else being misrepresented. The thought was that it might be much... It might be more readily doable to promote unionization, because I would share your view that Galbraith wrote about the need to have equal power on both sides of the labor table. If we could also move in the direction of Scandinavia, which this person, economist, claimed had a union movement that was much more directed at wage negotiations and didn't get terribly involved in work rules and was actually supportive of productivity. Now, I don't know if that's an accurate description of what happened in Scandinavia or not, but if so, then the unions actually became part of, almost a partner with business, at least with respect to productivity. Alan shaking his head, yes. And then they would negotiate over wages. How do you split the pie?
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, I think that's happening more and more in the workplace in this country. Unions understand that the success of their company is a success for them. There is, I go to a lot of plants in my state, a lot of businesses, manufacturing, not union, non-union. And union plants now, almost always, union and management meet together and talk about their cooperation. And I don't see the tension I might have seen between them that I saw a decade or particularly two decades ago. So the answer to that's yes. We need to do more of that. I think the organized labor understands that.
Right. I've been writing about this for more than 20 years on and off. I think it's exactly the trade-off. Better wages for more less restrictive work rules. Now, having said that, Alice said we're not Greece. We're not Sweden either. This is a big country with people geographically dispersed doing all sorts of things. Hundreds of millions of people, not a handful of millions of people. The key difference in the Scandinavian union negotiations compared to America has always been their centralization. Once you get it centralized, and you're negotiating with one labor confederation instead of Lord knows how many different unions and non-unions, it's easier to focus on national priorities, like what's better for our country. And while that would be very nice to dream about, we're just never going to do that in a country of 310 million people.
But it's still an issue, Michael, that from the point of view of the Hamilton Project might really be worth giving some thought to and see if we can make some contributions. Perhaps the Senator could help us as well.
Love to.
Ed, you're interested in housing, and I think have some interesting ideas on housing, and I think they relate to capital reallocation. And then if you had a moment or two in addition, the financing of infrastructure is something you've given some thought to, and we'd appreciate hearing that as well.
Yeah. Thank you. America has just experienced an extraordinary housing convulsion. Between 2001 and 2006, the Case-Shiller 20-city index increased by 53% in real terms. For every dollar that a city saw its prices rise over that period, it then saw its prices fall by 75 cents over the next 3 years, as housing prices throughout the nation declined by 33%. There is, of course, a direct parallel between that price event and the construction event that also occurred. America was producing 1.9 million units per year in both 2005 and 2006, and now, of course, we're down under 800,000 units being produced last year. This has been an extraordinary gyration, and the sad truth is we actually don't understand it very well. It would be comforting, it would be nice to believe that we can explain this event just with easy money, just with low interest rates or with aggressive approval rates on the parts of banks, but hard statistical work on this stuff tends to find that we can actually explain very, very little of the boom, no more than a third, with low interest rates or with aggressive approvals or with high loan-to-value ratios. We just don't understand the full set of the psychology and the full set of the dynamics that then created that boom. But that doesn't mean that we can't draw lessons from this, and it doesn't mean that we can't think seriously about reforming the policies that, even if they did not create the boom, they certainly abetted it. And I think first and foremost among those policies are those that artificially subsidize Americans to borrow as much as they possibly can to bet on the vicissitudes of the housing market. I think, you know, in the wake of this event, I hope that no one yet again sees subsidizing homeownership as an unfettered way to create an ownership society where everyone gets rich. It's also a great way to make sure you have a whole lot of defaults and a whole lot of people who owe a huge amount of money. In the current situation, in a crisis, in a downturn, there are two rival, contradictory impulses that come forward in government policy. One of those can be, you know, blandly overviewed as recovery, stasis, doing something to blanch the horror, right? And that pushes towards the status quo. That pushes towards more of the same. That push towards the home buyer's tax credit. That push towards, look, housing prices have fallen, but let's do everything we possibly can to stop them from falling further. That's a completely understandable motivation, but it stands at complete odds with the necessary long-run move for reform, which actually asks about looking at those policies and actually asks whether or not we can actually make longer-term changes that would then wean America off subsidized credit coming both through the home mortgage interest deduction and through the implicit subsidy that worked through the government-sponsored enterprises. I believe we're at a point of stability in housing markets, at least in terms of prices, where we can actually contemplate reform rather than just recovery, where we actually can think about putting in place in a gradual, sensible fashion those reforms that will actually move America towards a more sensible approach towards its housing markets. Our prices have stayed stable for many months. The core economics in markets like Arizona, markets like Phoenix and Las Vegas suggest that we are about where we should end up in terms of long-run prices. Florida may still have a bit to go. But at least in prices, we seem relatively stable. In quantities, we're still enormously low. But we will remain enormously low until the rate of new household formation picks up. We overbuilt about 2 million units during the boom. And until new household formation sops up that housing glut, we're never going to be back up at 1.3, 1.5 million units a year. So I think the big long-run reform, the big thing that we really need to think about is this sacred cow of the home mortgage interest deduction, which is in need of a good stockyard. The policy, let's just count its sins, right? So the first sin is that it subsidizes Americans, it bribes Americans to borrow as much as possible to bet on housing. It also, of course, is an implicit subsidy towards the banking system. And as we think about, you know, channeling America's activities towards other enterprises, other industries, we should think about that as well. But how in the world can it make sense, after experiencing this convulsion, that we want to bribe Americans to bet as much as possible on where housing prices in Las Vegas will be a year from now? How can that possibly make sense? The second odd force of this subsidy is that it encourages Americans to build as big and as much as possible. It privileges the housing sector over other forms of investment, and it encourages Americans to buy as big houses as they possibly can. Already, poor Americans live in houses that are roughly the size of the average Frenchman or the average Englishman. How in the world, in an age of global warming, when carbon emissions rise roughly one for one with the size of a house, can it possibly make sense for the government to be encouraging people to build bigger houses? Third, we have for decades subsidized people to leave our cities, our precious urban areas, which are the engines of our economic enterprises, where people get smarter by being around other smart people. We have engaged in a series of policies, among them the home mortgage interest deduction, which has pushed people to leave cities. There's almost a one-to-one counter, almost a one-to-one relationship between structure type and ownership type. More than 85% of single-family detached houses are owner-occupied. More than 85% of multifamily dwellings with five or more units are rented. When we bribe people to live in owner-occupied units, we're telling them to leave apartment buildings and leave the cities that are houses to those apartment buildings. Fourth, as everyone here knows, we've just had a lot of talk about income inequality. The home mortgage interest deduction is wildly regressive, right? The average benefits from the deduction for people earning more than $250,000 a year, for families earning more than $250,000 a year, are 10 times the benefits that accrue to households earning between $40,000 and $75,000 a year. And those are just homeowning households. That ignores the whole set of the world that actually doesn't own homes, which is actually substantially poorer. Accompanying that regressivity is the fact that this is a very poorly targeted policy if we actually wanted to encourage home ownership. The relatively wealthy people who get the bulk of the benefits are going to be homeowners anyway. By focusing the home mortgage interest deduction on in a way that channels benefits to that group, you're making sure that they're not being targeted to the people lower down on the income level who are genuinely on the margin between owning and renting. So what should one do? What could one do? I think, this is not an out-of-the-blue thing. Economists have been talking about reforming the home mortgage interest deduction for years. In fact, President Bush's tax reform panel talked about what I think is the most sensible gradualist approach, which is lowering the cap on the home mortgage interest deduction. We already have a cap at $1 million. It could be brought down $100,000 per year over the next 7 years. It's unlikely that this relatively incremental change would actually have a large impact on housing prices in the short run. In the long run, it could move us to a world in which we both raised more revenue and made the system less fair and less distortionary. I think, though, in the longer run, we should also think about replacing, not augmenting as was done in the recovery, but replacing the home mortgage interest deduction with just a straight homeowner's tax credit. With just a straight benefit that does not scale up with the size of your house and does not scale up with the amount of debt that you borrow. If we actually feel that this country really wants to subsidize homeowning, I think that in and of itself is a debate worth having. But if we are confident that we should do it, we should have just a straight tax credit that privileges homeowning rather than something that is an encouragement to borrow and bet and build. So let me stop there.
Okay.
I didn't get to the infrastructure.
No, but your proposal isn't going to pass in the Congress tomorrow anyway.
I think not.
I'm not licensed to practice politics, but I just have an instinct. give us 1 minute on infrastructure financing. Is there some, look, Alice has already gone through this. We have this enormous fiscal, unsustainable fiscal situation for as far as you can see, and many people think it's worse than it's said to be. In addition, you've got to fund the rollover every year or the maturities every year of very large amounts of debt. Is there some way to get this infrastructure that doesn't go on the budget?
I think like all economists, I'm a fan of user fees, right, insofar as they're possible and collectible. I think it's hard not to think that we want to actually charge people for the social cost of their action, and that certainly includes using infrastructure. I think it's there's a real challenge facing our infrastructure needs, and that it seems apparent to everyone that this country has significant infrastructure needs, and yet we are incredibly bad at directing our funding to the places that need it most. One of the graphs that I'm fondest of is the relationship between Recovery Act per capita spending, which is mostly infrastructure, and the unemployment rate. Of course, that relationship is negative. We spend the most in the places that have the lowest unemployment rates, and we spend the most in those places that had lower unemployment as of December 2008. That follows from the way that we allocate transportation spending primarily. We give money to places that have a lot of roads relative to people, and as a result, the Great Plains states in Alaska end up with a great deal of infrastructure spending. I think it's hard not to think that we need to rethink that. We need to rethink the infrastructure spending, which has also been a part of the anti-urban trifecta of public policy over the last 60 years. And I think it really does make sense to think about a more sensible infrastructure policy that starts with user fees.
Okay. We have questions from all of you all. Let me start with this one. We have three economists on the panel, and one of the questions is, recognizing that we have a lot of excess capacity right now, but hopefully we work our way through that. All that itself is a very big question, but assuming we get back to something that is relatively full employment, what do you think the long-run full employment rate of growth in the United States is likely to be? In the context of a highly more competitive global economy?
I'm an optimist on this. I'm looking at recent productivity performance in very difficult times when it usually deteriorates badly. And I cannot reconcile that kind of performance with a deterioration in the long-run productivity trend. So I'm on the high side of 3, maybe 3.25. Three and a quarter, that kind of a number for the long-run growth, of which about 75 basis points is going to come out of population. The race is coming from productivity.
Alice?
I'd agree with that. I think the productivity increases really since the mid-90s through thick and thin have been mysteriously high, but that's terrific.
Could I ask, well, Ed, I actually have a follow-up question. But
I'll pass it to you.
You'll pass?
I don't do macro forecasts.
Okay. Well, I'm a retread lawyer. So for the two of you given that answer, if you look at high-speed rail, where China now has better technology than we have, you look at the various areas that the senator raised where we're importing panel glass, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, mostly.
And a lot of other technologies are now being developed as effectively in substantially lower-wage countries that have become... managed to educate at least some elite very effectively so that they can be productive at what seem to be considerably lower cost than we have. How do we get to the levels of growth that you're talking about, given the constraints that the fiscal situation provides with respect to public investment?
Well, I'd go with Ed on some of the public investment, the infrastructure. I think we really have to finance it in a way that will give us a more efficient system. I think that means, with respect to transportation, it means forget the gas tax. We may have a carbon tax for other reasons. The gas tax is diminishing as our vehicles get more efficient, as they should. We need to do road use pricing, charge everybody for the use of the roads and more for congested times, and use that to aggressively improve our transportation infrastructure.
Look, I have long thought we're woefully undersupplied with public infrastructure. However, realistically, it's private investments that are going to drive this productivity. Some more public investment will help someplace out of the decimal point, but it's fundamentally private investment. And the truth is, we're quite good at that in America, at investing private resources productively. We have our lapses, and we've just had a whopper. Of a lapse, but generally we're pretty good at it, and that's where it's coming from.
We only have time for about, I think we have 4 more minutes before we have to adjourn because the senator has to leave and also the vice president is coming. But if you think about private investment, Alan, what is most likely, and then I want to ask the senator a final question, what is most likely to give rise to higher levels of private investment? Is it the sort of thing Roland Fryer was talking about before, or?
To some extent, the more productive work. You either have to lower the costs or increase the returns. So I was talking about, for example, increasing the returns to green innovation and green technology by raising the price of fossil fuels. A better educated workforce is a resource. The tax system matters also, and our corporate income tax is a mess. It's a whole variety of of things of that nature.
I don't see any evidence that we ran out of ideas. What happened here was a financial crisis that threw a pretty well-functioning economy into total disarray. It wasn't running out of ideas.
Senator, you are there every day with your colleagues focusing on the public policies of the country. You've now been kind enough to join us for an hour of discussion and contributed enormously, thoughtfully, to thoughts about where we need to go, where our public agenda needs to go. Is our political system going to be able to deliver what our policy people say our public agenda needs?
I think it is. We all think this is a more partisan time than any time in our lifetimes. We think the Senate probably and the Congress is more dysfunctional. I tell one real quick story. In the 1950s, when the Senate couldn't pass civil rights, even though the House wanted it, the President Eisenhower wanted it, and the country wanted to move forward in civil rights in the 1950s. A New York Times reporter really talking about the segregation of Southern senators said that the United States Senate is the South's unending revenge for Gettysburg. And, you know, I think it's important to put all this in historical context, whether you look at what happened with Medicare, how hard it was to pass Medicare. We don't think that today. How hard it was to pass health care. They had the Tea Party today, had the John Birch Society then. After Medicare passed in 1965, several Southern senators tried to block its implementation because they knew one thing Medicare would mean. It would mean integration of Southern hospitals. And Lyndon Johnson summoned the right people to the White House and said, if you want any tax dollars for your doctors or hospitals, you're going to integrate. And that was the same year, as I said, civil rights passed. And I think that we find a way to rise to the challenge, and I think we will. And I would close with this. Now, my mother and father, actually, during World War II, my dad was back from Persia, and they met at this hotel, the Mayflower. So I was like coming here. But my mother taught me never to be rude to your hosts. But I pick up this water bottle. And this water bottle, my understanding is this water bottle was made in China. The plastic was made in China. The bottles were then shipped to Fiji, filled with, at least they say it's filled with water from Fiji, and then shipped here. And I guess I don't understand how our trade policy and our tax policy makes this, not to mention our climate change policy, makes this an intelligent thing to do. So, anyway. But nonetheless, I still drank it, so I guess I ought to stand for some principle, shouldn't I?
Senator, I think that's a very good note to end our discussion on, because, as you said, there's some peculiarities in the sensibleness of that.
There are.
We thank you, Senator. We thank all of you for being with us, and you've given us lots of things about it.